I'm going to give these four talks in 25 minutes. It's a pleasure to be here for Bill Langford. I also was here a couple of years ago. These are kind of all the same thing. This is an attempt at being funny, how to solve equations without the equations. This is a quip. This is called equation-free stuff. It has to do with matrix-free methods, that's why. This is what we really do. We want to enable microscopic simulators like kinetic Monte Carlo, lattice Boltzmann, molecular dynamics simulations to do systems-level tasks, in particular bifurcation analysis. And this sounds a bit pretentious, the system engineering of multiscale simulations, but you will see that there is many issues of what we call system stuff, identification, filtering, and so on and so forth that come up. There's many people that I've played with the last few years. Bill Gear, this is the Gear of Gears method, is one of the main collaborators. He's the best postdoc you can ever find. He retired from running the Neck Institute a couple of years ago. He works very hard. He programs. He has wonderful ideas, and he doesn't get paid. I've been very lucky. I should say maybe a good way of saying this stuff in this context is that a long time ago, when I was a postdoc in Los Alamos, was exactly the time when Frisch, Haslacher, and Pomo happened. That is, when people were able to get lattice gases that looked like flows. And I am very much a numerical bifurcation person, and I always hated at the time that the thing looked like Navier-Stokes, but I could not do bifurcation analysis. I could not find saddles. I could not find stable and unstable manifolds. But it did look like a flow. So it took me 15 years or so to kind of find a way to do bifurcation analysis in lattice gases. This is boilerplate stuff. There are many problems that we think of as simple because we have models for their behavior that are at the level of description that we are interested in. Think of laminar Navier-Stokes. It's an extremely complicated problem. There's molecules running around, colliding with the walls. Yet, because we don't really care where every molecule is, but we really care where the velocity field is and what the pressure drops are, we have equations, macroscopic models, the laminar Navier-Stokes, that describe the macroscopic behavior, what we're interested in, and so the complexity we just don't see and don't talk about. However, these days, there's lots of problems in which we have descriptions at a fine level, atomistic, stochastic, and then we would like to have macroscopic equations, but we are not bright enough, to get closures for the microscopic rules to translate them into macroscopic equations, and Landau is dead, and I cannot ask him for a closure. And so what I'm trying to do, what I will talk to you about today, is to try and get a bridge between microscopic / stochastic simulation and all the traditional continuum numerical analysis that you know. This is supposed to work. This is, again, very much a numerical talk. This is supposed to work in cases where macroscopic equations exist and close. It's just that I don't know how to write them down. So what I'm going to tell you is that it is possible to solve these macroscopic equations, analyze them, integrate them, bifurcate them, control them, optimize them, without ever writing them down, by writing software wrappers around fine-level microscopic codes. The idea is that at the top level are all the codes we know and love, like Otto. At the bottom level are all of these things that we get from chemists or physicists, and sometimes we write ourselves. And the interface, this is the basic point, it's very simple, is the following. Every time that the upper-level code wants to do a function evaluation, what we do, what it does, is that it sets up and runs an appropriately initialized short burst of microscopic simulation with a microscopic code. In effect, every time you want a number, you do an experiment with a microscopic code to get that number. And so, as I say here, I would like you to think of the microscopic simulator as an experiment that the macroscopic code can set up, run, and process its results at will. We call this equation free because it works without equations. Of course, it works with the molecular dynamics, or it works with the Monte Carlo. It works without macroscopic equations. As you will see, there is a connection with matrix-free iterative linear algebra. I'm going to tell you some stuff about algorithms, like coarse integration, patch dynamics, coarse bifurcations, blah, blah. Some of the tasks, in particular, for this conference, bifurcation calculations, I'm going to have some examples, and I will probably not have time for nebulous thoughts, but maybe I will. This is a very simple slide, but it's the heart of what I'm going to tell you. At a religious level, equations embody practical determinism. Tell me a few things about the problem, and I'm going to tell you where the problem is going to be in a little bit of time. I'd like you to think of, sometimes we write equations for the problem itself. Sometimes we write equations for the statistics of the problem, like population balances, for example. I'd like you to think very naively of how it is that we use equations when we have them. And in particular, let's think of one task, integration. How do we use equations when we do integration? The simplest integration, forward Euler. We take at a given time a particular initial condition, and then what we do is that we go to the equation with the initial condition, and the equation gives us a slope, a number, a slope. And now, given where we are and this slope, we build a local linear model. And with this local linear model, we make another prediction. And then, having the prediction, what we do is that we go to the equation again, and with the new number that the equation gives us, we get another local linear model, and we make another prediction. So I'd like you to think that in some sense, what numerical analysis is, in particular, what forward Euler is in this case, is nothing more but a protocol of where to do function evaluations. You do the first function evaluation, process it, and that tells you where to, Euler tells you where to do the next one. You do that one, process it, and that tells you where to do the next one. So not only, trust me in this, or you will see if you think a little bit, that not only integration, but almost all the algorithms that we do can be thought of as where should I do the next function evaluation? In the same way that there exists design of experiments to get parameter values, design of experiments to do model discrimination, numerical analysis is design of computational experiments to do something. The something could be integration, Newton-Raphson, renormalization, whatever you want to do. So I'd like you now to think of two people that do not have equations but can do experiments. An experimental experimentalist, who is in the lab, and somebody who looks a lot like many of the graduate students that we get these days, people to whom we give codes but are very afraid of going into them and changing them. Or you can think of this as somebody who gets a legacy code from a company. They give you, or from a national lab, they give you a dynamic simulator, but there's too many years of work in there, and you would like to do something with it, but you don't want to go in and change it. So you can run the problem, but you don't have the equations to look at. So in both cases, both the experimental experimentalist and the computational experimentalist who doesn't want to go into the code can run for a short time. The little jiggles are supposed to say that this could be noisy. This could be, let's say, run for 1 second, and then using an estimate of the slope from the 1 second run, they can both predict, make a pretty decent prediction of where the computation or the experiment is going to be 10 seconds down the line. And now the idea is that the computational person has a huge advantage over the experimental one, because the computational person who ran for 1 second and made this prediction can immediately reinitialize the code at the prediction, run for another second and jump 20 more, run for another second and jump 20 more. In effect, what we are doing, is that we are using smoothness of this equation that we don't have in order to shrink time. We do our calculations in less time than necessary. The experimental experimentalist may have a very good idea of where the thing is going to be 10 seconds or 10 minutes down the line, but he cannot or she cannot initialize a flow field in detail. So even though they know where it's going to be, they kind of have to wait until it gets there. So in effect, what I'm trying to tell you is that it is possible, if you could initialize an experiment at will, which happens these days more and more, or if you have a computation that you can initialize at will, then in effect, you can do forward Euler without the equations by just doing short bursts of experimental experimentation or computational experimentation. So this is the basic thing that I am telling you about today and that I've been working on in the last few years, which is do numerical analysis, but do it with short experiments using another representation, molecular dynamics, kinetic Monte Carlo, lattice Boltzmann, or a code that the company gives you, or an experiment. If you do numerical analysis directly on an experiment, if you can initialize it at will. The first thing that we did with Bill Geer is to do some numerical analysis for such straight integration schemes. We call them projective integrators because there is an inner integrator, which could be a numerical integrator, could be a kinetic Monte Carlo simulation, could be an explicit solution for some time. You run for some time. It's important to run for some time first, exactly as John Guggenheimer was saying before, because you have to come down to a slow manifold. And after you run for some time, so all of this stuff works for problems that have gaps in their eigenvalues. It is important to have gaps in the eigenvalues so that you can jump in time and benefit. You run for some time, estimate the time derivative and jump. Run again the detailed problem from some time, estimate the time derivative and jump. And again, if there does exist a slow manifold, then the fact that you run the real problem again brings you back down to the slow manifold. What one is really doing, if you think of this as space, this as time, and this is the solution, we are at the moment running all of space for a short time using the smoothness of the equation that we cannot write down and saving time, jumping. This is an example. I have a few examples, and the last example is a bit funny. I hope you will think it's a little bit funny. This is the first example. It's not funny. It is a bacterial chemotaxis, as Hans Hofmer does it in Minnesota. Cells are little points on the computer. They live on the line, and they have three speeds. They either go this way, or they go this way, or they are tumbling, trying to decide whether to go this way or that way. The cells are distributed over six binary variables that say whether their flagella, of which they have six, are moving clockwise or counterclockwise. And as the cells go, they flip their flagella. Here is one movie that shows them. I want you to look at the guy that will show up here. It looks as if they have only one flagellum, but you see, before the guy changed velocity and disappeared from the picture, these flagella would fly apart. So these are these particles, of which there is 20,000 in the simulation that I'm going to show you. They are distributed over six binary random variables, and they are also distributed over two internal variables that tell them, as they have been running, have they been seeing a lot of food? If they have been seeing a lot of food, they like to continue running this way, and so the random flipping on their flagella is biased to keep them running in the direction in which there's lots of food. I'm not doing justice to the problem, but basically, the point is, you have a population of things that are distributed over six random variables and two continuous variables, yet, here comes now knowledge of people that have worked experimentally with the problem, yet people come and tell you that it is possible to write deterministic equations in terms of only one quantity, the density of cells. It doesn't matter how many are going to the right and how many are going to the left. It doesn't matter how many have clockwise or counterclockwise flagella. It doesn't matter what their interior state is that remembers whether it is possible to write deterministic equations with only one quantity, which is cell density. I'm not this moment discussing why this happens. I am just asking you to think of if somebody comes and tells you that this is true, that it is possible to write closed equations only with density, how could you use this? And a way that you can use it is to take an initial condition in density in space, lift to particle distributions that have this density, run them for some time, and after some time, again this has to do with separation of time scales, observe their density, keep running, keep observing their density, and now that you have a short movie of how their density is evolving, estimate the time derivative of the density field and jump. And then start again. What are we doing? We are doing forward Euler, based on experiments with the kinetic Monte Carlo simulation of the cells. The tools, this tells you that I shouldn't do light blue, the tools are lifting how to take macroscopic observables and make them into distributions conditioned on these macroscopic observables. Restriction, after you run for some time, how to take the distribution and make it into observables. All the mathematics are done with the macroscopic description on the observables, and all the actual running is done with the microscopic description, the kinetic Monte Carlo. And what you see here, this is cell density in space and time. This is cumulative cell density, which is a nicer thing to work with. The blue stuff is running all the time kinetic Monte Carlo. The red stuff is running some of the time, estimating the time derivative of the density field and jumping. So you see that you can save time. This is what is actually happening. It's too busy a slide. It will play a few times. Red is, here is cell density. Here is cumulative cell density. Red is coarse integration. Run for some time, estimate time derivative, and jump. Blue is running all the time. These are cells actually going right and left and tumbling. And when they, here are the cells running all the time, and here is the cells run, projected, reinitialized, run, projected, reinitialized. This is supposed to just give you a visual idea that when I reinitialize them very quickly, all the statistics of the distribution are coming up very quickly. So here's something which is very simple, but I hadn't digested, I guess, very well in graduate school. Most of the equations that we write, all the continuum partial or integral differential equations that we write, they really are equations for the evolutions of statistics of distributions. For example, if you think of particles distributed over velocities, One writes equations for example, for density and momentum, the zeroth and first moment of these distributions. And so the important question is, how is it possible that all particles are important, all moments are coupled together, yet when we write the laminar Navier-Stokes, we write equations that are closed only with the zeroth and the first moment. Where are all of the pair and triplet and quadruplet probabilities? And that turns out to be a problem of separation of time scales. So if we take an initial condition in, let's say, density and momentum and lift it to particle distributions conditioned on these low-order moments, there is many, 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 many ways of initializing all of the higher-order moments. Which is the right one? It doesn't matter, because very quickly what happens is that all of the mistakes that you do in the higher-order moments get healed. That is, there is a separation of time scales between the evolution of these observables in terms of which we write macroscopic equations and all of the other ones. So you can either do chemotaxis if you have the equations, or if you don't have chemotaxis but you have kinetic Monte Carlo, you can lift to cells, run cells for some time, and then come back down, restrict to density, and then you can do, for example, integration. So the basic point is, again, a fast, slow problem or a separation of time scales. We may have these, think of this as the equation for the low moments, the ones that we write deterministic equations for. These are all the higher moments, the triplets and quadruplets and the distribution of how many flagella go left and right. What happens is that relatively, very quickly, even if we don't initialize right, very quickly the higher order moments will equilibrate or come down on the manifold, and therefore we can use a quasi-steady state approximation, if we are smart enough to write it down, in order to get a reduced equation in terms of only the low-order observables. If we are not smart enough to write it down, then what we can do is that we can initialize, run constrained on the density for a short time, and then let the system free and observe the DDT of the slow variables. That is, let the system dynamics itself get the closure for you when you need it. Think of this as a closure-on-demand approach. Instead of trying to get a formula for the closure, you run the system itself for a short time to get it to tell you what the closure is. Inertial manifolds, in some sense, qualitatively is the same idea. High modes get slave to low modes. Here, higher order moments get slave to lower order moments. And in general, things like approximate inertial manifolds, closures and free energy surfaces are cousins of each other in this context. What you see here is a picture that just tells you very qualitatively that if I initialize things with some flagella going right and some flagella going left, very quickly, compared to the long-term dynamics, the right distribution of left, right, and tumbling cells gets established by the simulation itself. In what I told you so far, I told you that things that I can use the smoothness in time of the closed equation I can't write down to jump in time. It actually turns out that I can also use the smoothness in space of the equation that I cannot write down, the density of cells, if it is smooth in space. I can use it so that I do my calculations. Again, this is space, this is time, and that's the solution. Not in all of space, but only in little boxes around what would have been mesh points for the equation, if I had the equation and could run it. We call these guys teeth, and these are the gaps between the teeth. So the calculations are done only in little chunks of space that are coupled through effective smoothness boundary conditions. We call this the gap tooth scheme because the calculations are done only in a small part of the domain. And it is possible to combine the two things that I told you. Smoothness in space so that you run only in little boxes, smoothness in time so that you run only in little intervals, and so effectively you can do the calculations in patches in space-time. So this is patch dynamics. And this is to show you that this can actually happen. This is 50,000 interacting particles that have been written. This interacting particle evolution rule has been written so that the density of the particle satisfies something close to the viscous Burgers. No particular reason for this. The important thing to say is that there are 50,000 particles. You can see the white swath in time. That's when we jump in time. And you also can see that the particle, you see these little blue dots? The particle live only in the blue dots. One runs in the blue dots, interpolates in space, and extrapolates in time. In order to do this, it is very important and non-trivial, I shouldn't give the idea that this is trivial, to have boundary conditions between these little boxes that impose effective smoothness. That's something which I have learned a lot from the computational material science literature, where people do a lot of this. Okay, so this was just to tell you that you can simulate in small space and time the alternative model. My heart comes much more in bifurcation analysis, and so the idea is, what else can you do if you can simulate? You can run in time, but if you have a simulator, can you do something else? And we all know that if we want to find steady states and bifurcations, let's stick with steady states for the moment, we don't find them by integration, we find them by contraction mappings, in particular Newton-Raphson. Make an initial guess, find the residual, get a straight line, solve the set of linear equations, make a new initial guess. Well, to do this, you have to have equations to evaluate the residual and to also evaluate the Jacobian and solve the equations. What if you don't have equations, but you have an experiment or a computational experiment? What you can do is that you can look for fixed points of the time one map, take an initial condition, run the simulator, and plot how much you moved. Now, you need a Jacobian. You don't have a Jacobian. So perturb the initial condition, run the simulator, plot how much you moved, and then use a secant method. This is trivial, right? This is Jacobian by numerical derivatives. Yet it is very important because this is a computational technology, a very simple computational technology that turns a dynamic simulator into a fixed point algorithm capable of finding both stable and unstable solutions, and in general, doing bifurcation diagrams. So it is possible through such an approach to turn simulators into bifurcation codes by writing wrappers around them. And this is the one place where some real numerical analysis comes in. If I have an initial condition and run for some time, perturb the initial condition by a known vector and run for some time, the difference between the two runs is an estimate of the inner product of the linearization of the time one map of this equation that I don't know and the known vector. And you should know, or you will believe me, that if you can do matrix vector products through function evaluations, then you can do matrix-free linear algebra, find eigenvalues and eigenvectors, do GM-RES and Newton-Krylov methods and conjugate gradients, and you can do anything, almost anything, that you can do with traditional numerical analysis. So the idea is that with short runs, you can do all the numerical analysis that you could do if you had equations. And what you see here, this is an idea that comes from Herb Keller, for whom many of us wrote a card for getting well, who is one of the grandfathers of numerical bifurcation theory. Herb Keller said some time ago that if I have a PDE time stepper, I can turn it through a wrapper into a bifurcation code. His method is called RPM. There are many others. This is a particularly smart, like quick and dirty one. And what we did is that we said that if there is no PDE, what we can do is that we can take the macro initial conditions, lift it to micro, run the micro for some time, come back down, and the wrapper does not realize that there is no PDE, and it merrily goes along and does the bifurcation and stability analysis of this equation that you do not know. And this is just a summary that says that you can take microscopic initial conditions, you can take macroscopic initial conditions, run, and then you can do things like Newton and Arnoldi. Just look at this. And so for the chemotaxis problem that I told you, it is possible to find the stationary distribution. It is possible to find the slow eigenvalues and eigenvectors of whatever the closure of the kinetic Monte Carlo is. I want to give you one more example, and this is the kinetic Monte Carlo example that I will skip over because I want to show you something which I was debating with myself whether to show. But I hope you will find it slightly funny, if nothing else. So this is something that a great postdoc of mine, whose name is Kostas Sietos, a Greek guy, a controls guy, did a couple of weeks ago, since Michael just talked about last week's stuff. So what you see here is a distribution of people that live between minus 1 and 1. This is the distribution running in time. This is just 10 guys that live in this distribution. This is the average of the x, the mean of the distribution. This is the variance of the distribution. And then I have to tell you what these guys do. What these guys do is most of the time they have a deterministic drift, but they get positive information and negative information. And when they get positive or negative information as Poisson processes, they jump to the right or jump to the left. And in addition, as they jump to the right or to the left, sometimes they get to 1. And when they get to 1, they buy, and they are thrown back to 0. You see why I was saying this is funny and I was a bit ashamed. This is supposed to be a model of some sort of market with an agent-based simulation. So these guys are jumping around, getting information and moving. And if they get to 1, they sell and they go back to 0. If they get to minus 1, they buy and their wish to do things goes back to 0. And you can see that the situation more or less is stationary. There is a mean and the variance that becomes stationary. The rate plus is the rate of buying. The rate minus is the rate of selling. Everything goes to a very nice steady state. And the thing that I want you to see is that there exists this one parameter G that says how much attention do they pay to buys and sells. So these guys have a drift on their own, they get information from the media that's positive and negative, and they keep track of some percent of sales and buyings globally. Now, it is possible to write a Fokker Planck for this problem. These are some of the details of the model. Each one of them has a particular drift, and then there is this random source, which is information. The information is Poisson. It is either positive or negative. When you get positive information, you make a small jump to the right, negative, a small jump to the left. It is possible to also keep track of the flux at minus one and plus one, that is how many buys and sells are going on. And it is possible to write at some limit a Fokker Planck for this, but I'm going to pretend that I'm not going in that limit and I don't know what the Fokker Planck is. I just have this agent-based model. So now I'm going to tell you what happens. This is completely phenomenological, although there is good work behind it. What I want you to see is that what I have changed between the previous simulation and this simulation is how much attention they pay to each other. That is, how much attention they're paying to buying and selling. And when I run this, it will kind of look as if things more or less are the same all the time, but you will see that suddenly everybody went and jumped off a cliff. That is, everybody went and sold. So what happens as you change a parameter, this mimetic parameter, how much you are paying attention to other people, what happens is that you have a nice stable branch and then you explode. And so how do you do bifurcation analysis on this, right? Well, we use all of this time stepper stuff that I told you about and lifting and running and restricting and doing Arnoldi and Newton-Krylovs. And what we do is that we can get a bifurcation diagram for the population. This is a stable population. And then when you get above a threshold, actually there exists a turning point bifurcation. So above here there is a burst. You jump, you go to infinity. But you can also now follow the unstable branch, and the unstable branch, the unstable expectation of the density of the population, actually you can find it, and then you can kick along its, it has a single coarse eigenvalue that is unstable, all the other coarse eigenvalues are stable. If you kick in the downward direction, then things are stable. This is kicking it downwards. That's sitting on a separatrix. You kick on the upward direction and everything goes away. And the little thing that, you see, if you can find steady states and if you can estimate Jacobians, then you can also write controllers. So what you find, what you see here, is the result of using the coarsely identified unstable steady state and the slow parts of its coarsely identified Jacobian in order to design a very simple proportional controller. If things go wrong, you just pay a bit more attention to negative information, and what this does is that it stabilizes the population. It's not important what the example is, and it is a little bit funny, but what I wanted to tell you is that by using these time stepper-based techniques, i.e., by using numerical experiments appropriately initialized and filtered instead of doing function evaluations, you can do all of these things that you could do if you had equations. I will say two things to finish. The first thing is something that I like a lot, and so I shouldn't, but I can't resist showing it. There is many techniques, there's many things that we try and find when we do bifurcation calculations. We want, for example, to find steady states and limit cycles and codimension one curves and so on and so forth, and one can do all of these things. Not easily, and paying a lot of attention to variance reduction and noise and how many copies you do, but it is possible to do. Another thing that we do is that we can find self-similar solutions. If you have a problem that travels, then we all know that if you travel along with it, it looks steady. If you have a problem that explodes or collapses, you can write a co-exploding or co-collapsing equation so that the explosion or the collapse also looks steady. This is something that you can do for partial differential equations. You know, this is a PDE, and this is going to the traveling frame. This is a PDE, and this happens to be going to the co-exploding or co-collapsing frame. What I wanted to tell you is that it is possible, well, I don't know how visible this is. This is the viscous burgers, and for the viscous burgers, you have a solution which, as time goes on, it collapses, travels, and sharpens. But if you go traveling along with it and collapsing along with it and sharpening along with it, it goes to a steady shape. It is possible to take these algorithms for continuum PDEs and turn them into algorithms such that when you run particles, that's the viscous burgers interacting particle simulation I showed you before, instead of having the particles travel, die, and sharpen, you can get the using the time steppers based on the particles, you can get the particles to go to a stationary state. In effect, it is possible to do coarse dynamic renormalization by initializing densities, making particles with these densities, running them, getting their densities, and rescaling the densities, and initializing with particles again. So what I told you is that it is possible to do dynamic renormalization coarsely with time steppers, which is a way of maybe looking at some phase transitions a little bit differently, although this is a tall order. And the last thing that I'm going to tell you, which is not the result, is something that I like to read. It is the abstract of a paper. So I had my own molecular picture, but I am not going to show it. I'm going to show you this. So this is me being a chemical engineer. Skip Scriven is the guy who taught most of the people in Minnesota scientific computing. Bob Brown is the provost at MIT. Maybe he's the next president. Bill Silliman is, Skip Scriven had the student that went this is a student that went and became a captain of academia, and this is a student that went and became a captain of industry. He went to ExxonMobil. This is 1980. This is Phil Holmes editing a conference on new approaches to nonlinear problems in dynamics. It's a SIAM book. It's a blue book. I remember having it back then. And I think that this is really lovely. Bear with me, even though I've run over. This is 1980. People do a lot of finite elements. The best computers are crazed, and the best numerical analysis you can do is, for linear algebra, it is like frontal solvers or banded solvers, sparse solvers for large problems. Skip says, the nonlinear PDEs for mass, momentum, energy, species, and charge transport can be solved in terms of functions of limited differentiability, no more than the physics warrants. See, this is important. You don't have to be analytical. You don't have to have Jacobi polynomials. Basis sets consisting of low-order polynomials, and systematically we generate and analyze solutions by fast computers, crazed at the time, modern matrix techniques, banded solvers or frontal solvers at the time. Basically, this is a generation who fought against having to do fluid mechanics only with paper and pencil and got to do stability and bifurcation and continuation. I think all of us, or most of us, have played a part or participated in this, being able to do mathematics or computer-assisted analysis on the computer, not only with formulas. Skip says, nonlinear algebraic equations are solved with the Newton-Raphson. The Newton-Raphson is greatly preferred because the Jacobian of the solution is a treasure trove for continuation, for stability, for bifurcations, for sensitivities, for stable and unstable manifolds. Basically, what this says is, even if the equations are given as formulas, you can do mathematics on numerically computed solutions. I'd like to think that in some general nebulous, so here's the nebulous thoughts. A long time ago, equations were analytical and solutions were analytical. Then equations were analytical and solutions were perturbative. Then equations were analytical and the solutions were on the computer. And I think that in what I'm telling you today is in some sense a reasonable next step. The equations are on the computer and the solutions are on the computer too. Thank you.